Welcome to the Midday. I'm Norman Gilliland, coming to again from Buck's studio, and with me for the umpteenth time, and what a pleasure, is Trevor Stevenson, who is the founder and the director of the Madison Bach Musicians.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Happy to see you again.
Whichever teenth it is, yeah.
That's right, whatever teenth it is. Yeah. And you've brought, I'm not going to say your instrument, it is yours, but it's an instrument, one of several that you and Norm Shepherd have collaborated upon the creation of.
So this instrument was built just a few miles from here by Norm Shepherd in his studio, and I purchased it from him and do the stringing and the quilling on it. It's a copy of an instrument that we know Johann Sebastian Bach actually went to Berlin and purchased at about 1719 from the original builder, who was named Michael Meitke, you know. But anyway, so Bach went there with check in hand from his employer at Curtin and purchased this double manual harpsichord and probably took it back to Curtin and played things like the Brandenburg Concertos and that. It's a concert instrument of the time. You can see, you know, it's 7.5 feet. It's got two keyboards, 189 strings in it, you know, so it's the Jaguar.
But we're still talking about a time before public concerts were really not a big phenomenon.
Right, yeah. So most music was performed for small groups of people, like we're doing here today. It's an intimate gathering at court, or, you know, especially with harpsichord music. It wasn't typically done in theaters, you know. Large settings like the church were for the organ. And the harpsichord was for accompanying the voice or playing with string instruments, and, of course, for solo music like we'll do today.
Class of 1685, now we're going to call that informally. We will dedicate the hour to that class, as we call it. And it is odd. It's almost as if there was something in the water in that year.
Yeah, or the comet came in.
Yeah,
we're talking comets now.
Right, right.
And so in 1685, Bach and Handel and Scarlatti were all born into very different social strata and different musical situations, but they all came in the same year. I think what's particularly interesting is that they're three, you know, mega geniuses, really, and they write quite differently from each other. That really makes the situation quite loaded, I think, you know. And what I want to explore is like the difference between their styles. And of course, I mean, they have similarities. Scarlatti spends his life at the keyboard, you know, writing his 550 keyboard sonatas, and he is to the harpsichord probably what Chopin is to the piano. Everything is worked out in this particular, you know, sound world of the plucked string in the wooden case, and it maximizes the aesthetic possibilities of it. Bach, of course, is a harpsichordist, an organist, a clavichordist, and all of that, and is writing, you know, very differently, much more contrapuntally than Scarlatti. And then Handel is really almost always operatically conceived, right? And the human voice, I think, is probably behind every note that Handel wrote, even at the keyboard. It's there, you know. And Handel, it's like everything's coming right out of your belly.
So, well, they were all flamboyant in their individual ways. Interesting, right. Though. I mean, you know, Scarlatti, of course, we can see from Italy, but spent a lot of time in Spain as being a stylist on his own right. But Bach and Handel, at least for the formative years, early years of their lives, live fairly close together, and yet they still have these very different styles.
In central Germany, so, you know, Scarlatti's father, well, since we'll start with him, I mean, his father, the great Alessandro Scarlatti, is a very prominent Roman opera composer of his day. So young Domenico, who we're going to be playing here, grows up in a household of tremendous musical privilege. You know, I always compare it to, it would be like being the son of Steven Spielberg and you wanted to go into film, you know. Domenico, he's imagine probably the greatest singers in Italy, if not in all of Europe, are coming through the living room rehearsing with Dad and that type of thing. Domenico grows up as this monster keyboard player, even as a young Buck. Yeah, there are stories of him.
They used to have duels, keyboard duels. Yeah, and then there were some people who would sneak a peek at him and then just Skip Town.
And Skip Town, right. I think he and Handel actually had a little playoff one
night.
And Handel, and in Rome, because Handel's a young guy in Rome, and Scarlatti is still there. And I think Handel, fortunately, wins on the organ. Scarlatti's not particularly interested in playing the organ. You know. And then, of course, no one can touch Scarlatti at the harpsichord.
When we get to Bach, we'll find out the Handel-Bach situation a little bit. It's kind of similar.
But Scarlatti, you know, in his late 20s, around the age of 30, he takes off for Portugal and has this wonderful job at the Portuguese court. He's the private tutor to the princess there. She grows up and, in a very political marriage, marries into the Spanish court and becomes Queen of Spain and takes Scarlatti with her. He's her lifelong, like, trainer, music, you know, personal trainer.
Good one to have.
Yeah, and somewhere, you know, in his, in his 40s, perhaps even, he starts collecting these 550 keyboard sonatas that
when we say that, these are not, you know, like hammer clavier size sonatas. Right. They're just a few minutes, they're miniatures.
They're two pages, three pages, four pages. Four pages is as long as they ever get. They're almost always a binary, that is, there's a repeat sign in the middle, and you go back and play the first page again, and then that second half, you repeat the second half, you know, time permitting kind of thing. But that's the form that he loved, and of course, his genius is that every time he writes in it, it's fresh. It seems like a new thing.
Yeah, 500 and some odd fresh sonatas, each distinct.
Right. I think, to comparison, I think he figured out that he was the what we would call the Hemingway of the short story. I mean, he could do in two pages what, you know, would take other people's two novels to do. And anyway, what a gift, and we're glad he jotted it down. No one knows for sure what happened, but there's some evidence, or at least strong conjecture, that the princess who becomes Queen of Spain finally says to him, "You know, are you ever going to get this stuff written down? These incredible improvisations that you're doing, and that, you know,
really,
imagine what it must have been. This is just what's written. Imagine what the improvisations must have been."
Yes.
So anyway, but he did. It is a kind of a later in life thing for putting it together, and we have his music only because of a few people taking care of it. I mean, these aren't European-wide publications. Some of them are published widely in England and other places, but many of Scarlatti's sonatas we have because people like Farinelli took good copies of it back to Italy, and there was only one or two copies, and those survived, and that's why we have it. So the point is, by a thread,
yes,
hangs.
Yes, like so many things. So, well, shall we hear a couple of those Scarlatti sonatas?
This is the first one is Kirkpatrick 9, Ralph Kirkpatrick cataloged Scarlatti sonatas. This is in the style of a pastoral. It means it's kind of a shepherd's song, very outdoors, open kind of feeling to it. And then that'll be followed by Kirkpatrick 380, which is in E major. It's a very famous one, which also has quite an outdoor feel, but more of a festive type of thing. So this is in D minor, followed by E major.
Thank you.
probably the most famous of the Scarlatti sonatas.
Probably the most famous, right? And you know, justly so. There's a reason why things are
famous.
Right,
yes.
As some great writer once said, it's just
it's sometimes mysterious, but there is, yes.
And I hope it's obvious that what the influence of guitars is in this. There's a lot of strumming going on, and Scarlatti. I always think he probably hung out with the guitar players in Spain and bought their drinks until he stole all their riffs. You know, it's like here's a, you know, do that.
Watch
do
out
that
for
riff
this
again.
Man.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But you know, but of course, what he brings to it also is the happiness of Italian music.
Yes.
This type of joy is a little bit more of an Italian flavor, I think. And no one can resist a happy Italian. I mean, it's like it's all there, right? It's all, and this piece just smiles, I think, in a wonderful way.
That's true. So much of his work. Well, if we can get fairly expeditiously into the contrasting sound of Bach. We'll go to the well-tempered clavier.
Exactly, right. Bach starts the well-tempered clavier around the age of 30. He says to a student later on that he begins the well-tempered clavier when time lay heavily on his hands, which I'm sure for Bach was 15 minutes.
Yeah,
that was unaccounted for.
Well, yeah.
But there is a chance that he might have begun the well-tempered clavier when he was under house arrest for a brief period when he was at Weimar and he had taken the job at Curtin and had not gotten a formal release from his boss at Weimar. So he spent a month, really, he couldn't go anywhere, you know, and it's about the time when we know the well-tempered clavier was started. So anyway, that's a juicy story. Who knows if it's true? But the well-tempered clavier, of course, is an exploration in the new tuning system of the time, well-temperament. And many writers of, you know, Bach's contemporaries, they wrote down what the tunings were, and by and large, they are temperaments which favor C major and G major and the commonly used keys, but provide access to the less commonly used keys like F sharp and D flat and things like that. In the period before Bach's tuning, it was again an all or nothing. Your C major was great, your C sharp major was terrible, and that was their way of honoring the mathematical dilemmas of music making. But in the 18th century, they came up with this new system called well temperament, in which C was sweet and D is also sweet, G is sweet. But if you do it in C sharp, the C sharp has a lot of spin and guts, and you can really hear, the vibrato versus C. And so these are high contrast between the sharp and the flat keys like that, which provides an amazing amount of expressive potential at the keyboard in an intercirculating system. When you get to the 20th century, this gives way to equal temperament, in which all the keys have the same kind of buzz to them, right? And there is no looking back up to C major the way that Bach had always, which is why the well-tempered clavier starts in C, you know, which is, it was symbolized purity and beginnings and clarity.
Stability and all that.
So in this one, we're going to start in E flat minor, okay? Bach, which is a no trespassing key, which is... Yeah, you can hear it. It's just, you're really sorry you opened the door, you know?
And, unless it's Bach coming on the other
right.
side.
You know. So he starts in E-flat minor, and it's so gritty because the E-flat, G-flat, and the G-flat, B-flat are highly energized mm-hmm. thirds, okay? And it's a scene of grief. I mean, they had 20 kids, and they lost 7 or so of them. I mean, it's that type of a horrible day.
They did get 4 composers mm-hmm. out of them, though.
So they got 4 composers out of them.
That
right.
was the bright side.
And when he goes to the fugue, he switches from 6 flats to 6 sharps. He goes into sharps like that. And in the manuscript to this, this prelude, which is so like gothic really in its feeling, the handwriting is shaking all over the place. In the fugue, it's clear as day like that. And the fugue is the answer too. We don't know if it was copied from different times or what. I mean, this is But it is, you can go look in the library. It's there, and it's
interesting contrast in the handwriting too. Then
I'm not the only person who believes that that Bach's handwriting, you can actually kind of see what's happening affectively as well in the handwriting. So not always, but sometimes.
And so anyway, this one is.
And this is the E flat minor and D sharp minor Prelude and Fugue, Well Tempered Clavier, Book One.
Thank you.
The B minor. Thank you so much. The B minor mass, the opening Kyrie, is very close in style to this fugue. It's a huge kind of a glacial rate, right? And in Glenn Gould's words, a self-entrenched concentration, which he I think is wonderful.
Well, there's always room for more Bach, and so let's accommodate some more.
Yeah, and I'm going to go high contrast here from the gnarled world of that E flat minor prelude and fugue into G major in the French suite in G major. I always think that G major in Well Temperament, especially with its great clarity, has a sunlight in the kitchen kind of qualities, right? And the kids are getting along and everyone's having a fine time. So this is Bach's suite in the French style. He didn't actually call these French suites. They kind of came down to us through his students and as being the style pieces in the French style. There's certainly a French elegance to them, but thought we'd just do a couple movements here. Maybe I know we're short on time. We'll do the Allemande and the Sarabande and the Gavotte. Thank you. Thank you. Thank
definitely, you. Definitely some sunshine in there.
Oh yeah, and the springing step. The gavotte is so unusual because it has this giant upbeat to it. It's an up, up, down, up, up, down, like that, right? The super munchkin dance.
That's right. Well, you know, I wish that we actually could see, in conjunction with these, sometimes people dancing these dances because none of us remembers right. what maybe the minuet, but otherwise we have really very little idea of what these dances looked like.
Right,
and of course, all these wouldn't have been written necessarily to a dance tempo with dancing in mind. They're very much reminiscent of those dances.
As solo keyboards. Yeah. They might have danced. We don't know. Right?
Go ahead if you feel so inclined. You know.
Yeah.
We're providing the music. Right. You can dance if you like.
I like at the end of this one too. He puts in this kind of roguish bass line. This. I mean, that's almost like a bad, intentional bad writing, you know? Like that. It's a scale that changes its mind three times in its phrase. But I think it's part of what, it's the party atmosphere. It's like, and there's a lot of holiday grog moving, yeah.
Tis the season.
Yeah.
Well, let's have a little contrast for starters between Bach and Handel. You mentioned that Handel is the composer of the theater or the opera,
exactly.
as opposed to Bach, who was maybe a little bit more indoors in his orientation for his composing.
Exactly.
So we have a Passacaglia, and what exactly is a Passacaglia?
It's a set of variations on a repeated bass line, like a chaconne. In fact, it and the chaconne are so close in their formal design that they're people argue about which is which, you know. So and you know, Handel goes to Italy at the age of 19 or so and spends quite a few years there hanging out with great Italian masters like Corelli and knowing the Scarlattis as well. He's always using this Italian material that he had, and this is very Italianate in its design. But I always think of Handel as the great composite composer, with bringing French kind of French bearing and elegance to it, right? His German harmonic sense and contrapuntal sense, which he was trained with, and knowing from the Italians that you have to have a tune that will sell, right?
That's true.
Right.
He was very practical.
Yeah, and the tune must, if the tune doesn't bother you for three, in a wonderful way, for 3 days, it's no good, right? Right, you know, and many of Handel's tunes, they, in the middle of the night, there they are, you know.
Earworms, those hit tunes.
Yeah. And they're hard to write, yeah. It's so, you know, Messiah is 2 hours of earworms. Yeah.
Never
so anyway,
put
so
that
this
way.
Is a set of variations on a repeated bass. Thank you.
Thank you. I know. Thank you very much. It's flamenco guitar, and it accelerates till it blows up.
I was going to say.
Right. And then it stops. Boom.
Potential train wreck there for the budding harpsichordist.
Oh, yeah. And I love how he stays with the chord progression until in the last page. You know, he's always with that very, you know, it's Baroque grandeur, you know? This thing, and a beautiful cycle. But in the last page, he goes... Then he gets the Phantom of the Opera stuff out like that, you know. It's like, right, but it's wonderful how he breaks the pattern there like that, and that it's the signal for the beautiful chaos that's coming, you know, in the very last page. I mean, his Handel's sense of dramatic pacing is just, you know, it's impeccable. He always knows when to pull the trigger. You know? So
more Handel.
Yes,
the crowd
right.
is calling for it.
As they did. You know, Handel, of course, you know, unlike Bach, Handel is actually very famous in his own day. I mean, he makes quite a bit of money. He's a celebrity. He's probably the Mark Twain of his day, and is closely watched by the public as well. So he must have been a tremendous improviser, particularly at the organ, we were told. And I thought we'd do a piece that it would be in contrast to the kind of the flash of that G minor Passacaglia. This is Handel's two movements from the E major suite. The first movement is, I think, what T.S. Eliot calls the evening with the photo album, right? I think there's a time for the evening with the photo album under the lamplight. It's from one of Eliot's quartets. But this is Handel at his most reflective and most personal. And then this very same suite closes with the Harmonious Blacksmith Variations,
oh,
which
very
he did
famous.
Not he did not name Harmonious Blacksmith, but the image that somebody gave to it has stuck.
It works.
With supposedly the smithy pounding out pounding on the anvil and singing to the top of his lungs. So two movements from the E major suite.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Gotta love that harmonious blacksmith.
I know. And only Handel, I always think that Mozart is the Handel's disciple. They have this sense of the theater and how to take what I call take the roof off. You know? I mean, everything builds toward one amazing moment like that. And you could hear, even if Bach had started a set of variations like this, you like even the Goldberg variations, but he doesn't really take the roof off. There's always a governor there.
Yes,
it's
that's
the Lutheran factor.
Yeah, that's
now,
there's
a governor there that because Bach wants a much kind of a longer burn, whereas Handel is cathartic, right? And it's all to be spent in one evening.
Gratification sort of thing. There
no, it is. I mean, but no one. I mean, he could do it so well, you know. And
well, it's interesting that you know Scarlatti had the influence of living in Spain all those years, and before that, Portugal.
Right.
And Handel goes to England. He's not even 30 years old yet by the time he settles for the rest of his life in England. But shall I ask this delicately, was English music so bland that Handel was not influenced by it?
Well, the English love importing musicians, right? They especially
in
the
18th
Italians,
century, they couldn't get enough of those Italians. Yeah.
Right. And of course, Handel has a very strong Italian component, too, with this fire and virtuosity. And so Handel had just everything England needed. I mean, you know... he did, and on top of it all, he had one element which is very hard to find in anybody else's music, which is God, Mother, and Country, is what I would call it, right? A sense of like patriotism in the music. It makes everybody want to stand up and salute, and it's a very rare thing. You know, Purcell maybe had a little bit of it, but Handel had it in spades. You know, so they loved him.
Yeah, well. Thank you, Trevor Stevenson, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Look forward to that next visit.